Thank you all. Thank you for that blessing, and thanks for having me back to Word and Life. Thanks, Tom, for that introduction. I feel like now I don't have to say anything else. You basically just gave my talk for me. But thanks to Judy and Maureen and others. I see friends around the room for being here this morning. It's great to be back with you, and I feel very privileged to speak to this group of wise people who have been on this path for a very long time. And so you all are studying a book called How to Live, yes? Okay, and I was given two chapters to reflect upon. One is called Running with the Light, right? Sounds really bright and beautiful. And the other one was called Death as Our Compass. So, you know, in a study on how to live, you've given me the task of telling you all how to die, in a sense. And all I can say is that I'm glad that you assigned me the easy topic, because I'm sure that everyone else will have a much more difficult time. That was sarcasm, in case you missed that. So, awakening and death is really the core of these couple of chapters. And I hope this morning that we can take an honest look at death as a path to awakening, and hopefully come away not making sense of it, because a paradox is not something to be understood or to make sense of, but that we might come away with a sense of an invitation to, in a sense, forgive the paradox itself of death, which is to say to let go of our tendency to shy away from death and to turn toward it so that it might become a source of transformation for us. I'm going to get this slide on here for you so that we can begin our morning. Hopefully this is still working. Let's see. Oh, got to take that. All right. I'm going to start with this quote from Thomas Merton from his book, New Seeds of Contemplation. He says, "To enter into the realm of contemplation, one must, in a certain sense, die. But this death is, in fact, the entrance into a higher life. It is a death for the sake of life, which leaves behind all that we can know or treasure as life, as thought, as experience, as joy, and as being. Every form of intuition and experience must die to be born again on a higher level of life." And that's in the very first chapter of his book, which is really his heart of trying to teach the path of contemplation. Now, this kind of contemplative teaching, has to be said at the outset, is inherently mystical, is it not? That is, it does not make logical or rational sense to us upon hearing it. That is because I think one goal of contemplative teaching is to bring us to a point of paradox, to show us a boundary so that we can learn how to go beyond it. And the boundary will always lead us to a place of beyond, or to a place of mystery, or to a place of paradox. Again, it's not something that can really be captured by words, but it's a sort of invitation to something beyond. And so surely death for the sake of life is one of these deep mysteries, these deep invitations. And perhaps I think it might even be the deepest that we will ever try to contemplate or enter into in our entire lives. And so Merton says that the invitation to enter the realm of contemplation is to die. To be sure, this kind of invitation, I think, when truly contemplated, will shake us to the core. Have you ever had an existential crisis, anybody, right? This brush with death, or taking this deep dive into your own consciousness, your finitude, your mortality, the sense of the apophatic, the sense of nothingness, the sense that can come when you really try to move into that place. It is not a cruise ship down there, is it? Right? It is disorienting. It is depressing sometimes. It can feel like a great loss is being taken up within you. And yet, these great spiritual teachers seem to still hold out this invitation before us. By Jesus, by St. John of the Cross, by Teresa of Avila, by Mother Teresa, and here by Thomas Merton, this invitation stands, that we are invited to die to truly live. So what could all these great spiritual teachers be hitting at here? How is it that death leads to life? How is it that, as Jesus says, a grain of wheat must fall into the ground and die in order to bear fruit? How is it that we must lose our lives in order to find them? How is it that Friday must somehow always come before Sunday can come? How is it that we must pick up our cross and head towards death in order to find life? Sometimes I think, I sit with these questions and I say, really, reality? Really, God? This is the path that you've laid out before us? I don't think this makes much sense to our very deep human intuitions, does it? It seems counterintuitive. But when we encounter pain and when we encounter death, I think our initial reaction, which is natural, is to recoil, to turn away from the pain. And maybe even often just to sprint as fast as we can in the other direction from the pain, right? Who in their right mind would actually want to naturally welcome death or welcome pain? Is this a call, a contemplative call that's disguised to really just be sadists or masochists, right? Is that what's happening here? Is this at the heart of this contemplative teaching? And the short answer is no. I don't think that's what it is at all. The teaching, in a sense, is that death is part of that narrow path that leads to life. That death is a path to a kind of awakening. I remember my first encounter with death as a young boy. One of my childhood friends had been diagnosed with a form of bone cancer at about 8 or 9 years old, and ended up battling that for a few years and dying around age 11. And I remember having to go to his memorial service and being outside of the church where it was being held and just crying uncontrollably, not being able to bring myself to even go in the building where they were having that. And I was also 11 years old, you know. And so had this first sort of intuition that this is not the way it's supposed to be, you know. And then I remember in high school, I got a call while I was actually in class one morning. I got called out of class to tell me that one of my beloved teachers, who was also a family friend and one of my basketball coaches, had died suddenly in his early 30s from a brain aneurysm on a boat trip with some friends. And I remember just, you know, having to let that emotion wash over me and then to call my dad and tell him the news, who was also a beloved friend of his. And then, you know, we cried together for one of the, I think, the only times in our lives that I can even remember my dad crying, you know. And then I think this issue of death became even more real to me when I was in my late 20s. About 2 years into my marriage, I was diagnosed with testicular cancer. So I was right in the middle of my early life in marriage, but also my process through working on my Master's of Divinity. And I was in prime health, and it came as a real shock at age 27 to get this news. And I remember when I got the call from the doctor, I remember the emotional episodes that ensued after that. I remember the numbing of the chemotherapy running through my body and, you know, and the ensuing existential questions that I carried on the other side of that I've been carrying ever since. And it was a horrific event, you know, to undergo this and to be in touch with your mortality in that way, that things could turn the other way really quickly. And I think that probably is the sole event that has changed the trajectory of my life forever. And so there are these moments in our lives where we experience this kind of brush with death. Sometimes it's somebody we love, sometimes it's ourselves. Has anybody else had these kinds of experiences before? It's not just me? Okay, good. Yeah. Friends, I just want to say this morning that death is a part of life. And I do not mean to be dismissive in any way, shape, or form about this. I've just shared with you a little bit of some of my engagement with it. But as you can see, I don't mean to say that people who die young or whose stories are cut short should just be something to be embraced and somehow that it's easy or anything like that. But what I do mean is that death will touch each and every one of our lives at some point. And in fact, I think it's actually deeply integral to our lives. And how we respond to it is what matters. Novelist Peter DeVries once said that death is the commonest thing in the universe. And sometimes it feels that way, doesn't it? But lest this talk become too one-sided or too dualistic around the topic of death, I want to this morning draw a holism around death, because death is actually not the only story. The contemplative claim is that we must die to live. And this seems not only to be a claim about the end of our lives, but it is also somehow about the middle of our lives. Or perhaps death could be even the beginning to a new kind of life, a new kind of way of moving throughout the world, or what Merton calls a higher life, or what I would maybe like to call a deepened life, or a whole life. You see, I think that the problem with life and death is that we all too often separate them out as if they were two separate things to be reacted to. Life is to be welcomed and enjoyed, and death is to be pushed away and turned away. But I think that part of the message of the gospel is that we are always dying into new life. We are always dying into new life. It's the very heart of the idea of resurrection, right? There you go. We're going to talk about Francis in a little bit, so I'm glad you brought that up, Tom. Thank you. And so this is the very heart of resurrection, as I said. And by the way, I mean this more than just theoretically. I mean this metaphysically, actually, because something like process metaphysics teaches us that every event of the world is a sort of dying into new life. That every instance of our lives, every moment perishes into a kind of becoming that will eventually perish again and on and on and on and on. It's the very fabric of our cosmos to pass away and to renew. We can't separate them out. These are one process. And there's not one fleck of matter in our entire universe that does not undergo this process. It is natural. It's natural. And I want to share a poem with you this morning that I love, I think that illustrates what I'm trying to say. So I'm going to read this. Sometimes things are better said poetically, right? Every breath of the world is a dying into life. Like the dew of dawn, soft as sea glass, wet with possibility, waits in darkness for the silent voice. That ceaseless refrain calling stardust to sigh, nudging it perpetually unto its becoming, to risk the drench of wonder again and birth a day unlike any other day, young and wild with light, quivering like a fawn, naive and new, fresh and intoxicating as baby's breath, a momentary bloom of the timeless and flashing dance that wilts evermore back into the belly of reality, as the dampening glow of Mother Eve spreads her cascading melancholy, a balm of passing beauty that coats like honey and conspires in all things, welcoming each one in its goodness to the rising chest of the horizon and to its tender fallen return. It's not, no. Every breath of the world is a dying into life. Every breath of the world is, in a sense, a kind of resurrection. You see, I think the problem, again, is when we chop death and life up. One is good and the other is bad. I think this is the dualistic mind showing itself, right? I think part of the invitation is to allow death to awaken us to the finite nature of our lives and to every moment, and to lead us to a sort of presence that can hold all of it together. You may recall Judith Valente's reflection from these chapters that she had met a cancer patient who had told her that death had made life meaningful, that her brush with death had somehow rendered life meaningful. And her authorial response was to say that this person was wrong, that it was actually life that makes death meaningful. And so we hold these questions. Is it death that gives meaning to life? Or is it life that gives meaning to death? I would say that if we went either way, it would be a sort of oversimplification. I wish we didn't have to hold the paradox of those questions, right? I wish we didn't have to take a side, although we all want to take the side that life is the way, right? I think that there's good reason to say that it is both, that death and finitude and mortality renders a kind of presence that opens us to beauty and joy and attentiveness, and that somehow life, as always birthing from death, as soaked in this level of awareness, can help us to hold death in a certain kind of light. Celtic poet and philosopher John O'Donohue said that God is where twilight and dawn are one. God is where twilight and dawn are one. And this is beautiful, non-dual thinking. What if the path to peace is actually a matter of life and death? Emphasis on the and. Do you hear that play? What if the path to peace is actually a matter of life and death? And not for us to shy away from death and go too far that way, or not to overemphasize life so much that we can't hold the reality of the passingness of our lives. I think it's too easy to do one or the other. We sometimes want to be caught up in one side. What if we let life cradle death? And what if we let death birth life? This is a great paradox. It is not something to be swept under the rug, but something to be held precisely as a mystery or as paradox, as a boundary or a limitation in our rational thinking to break us down and break us open into new regions of thought and acceptance and forgiveness and the like. Perhaps a claim like this might make more sense when viewed as contemplative wisdom. So far we've talked about it both as this existential insight of our own engagement with death and suffering, and of our lived experiences as human beings. And we've also talked about it as a sort of metaphysical insight about the nature of the flowing cosmos as a way to view the movement of the universe. But what is the contemplative wisdom for us in this invitation? Surely Merton's invitation includes these more literal renderings of death and life that we've talked about. But perhaps his invitation, again, is a little bit more mystical than that. What is this higher form of life, which again I might call a deepened existence or a whole life, that Merton is writing about and that Jesus invites his followers into? I think that one of the best ways to name this invitation is to say, as Father Richard Rohr says, that we are invited to forgive reality for being what it is. It's a good one. It wasn't meant to be a joke, but it's so funny it's true, right? It's that kind of a thing. And he calls this an act of letting go, right? Forgiveness is an act of letting go. And to me, I think that this sounds like what it means to die a mystical death, right? Is to learn to forgive and to hold all of reality. And to forgive it for what it is. On this theme, he reflects that forgiveness becomes central to Jesus' teaching because to receive reality is always to bear it. Our experience is always bearing reality. To bear with reality for not meeting all of our needs all the time. To accept reality for being what it is, almost day by day and almost even hour by hour. And I could say sometimes it's almost even second by second, just breathing, right? Such a practice creates patient and humble people. And then he goes on to say that forgiveness is the Christian word for letting go. Friends, I think that to enter the contemplative mind, we must find the power within us to forgive reality for being what it is. And in the context of this presentation, perhaps that means to forgive death for being what it is. Let me reiterate that this does not make rational sense. It's not our first inclination to forgive death. It's our first inclination to shy away often and to deny, right? And then to go through our stages of natural grief. And I don't even think it's our 100th inclination to forgive it, right? But it is the invitation. I think this is the relationship between death and awakening, or death and waking up. We see differently when we have seen death. Again, the rule of St. Benedict says, day by day, remind yourself that you are going to die. Oh, that sounds like a fun morning prayer, right? Just that little mantra or that repetition prayer, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. Doesn't sound that fun. But why does he say to do this? Again, is he just another masochist or another sadist? No, I don't think so. I think he's saying this because when we learn to forgive reality for being what it is, when we learn to embrace our own death, when we learn to somehow die before we die, then we enter into a sort of awakened state of living, where we are free, where our eyes can see clearly the passingness of our every moment, and then we become free to live in the now. To clean up our presence, to be a sort of welcoming presence, and to be present to joy when it is available, to be present to beauty when it is available, and also, though, to be present to suffering and to pain, and yes, even to death when it shows itself. This is somehow the invitation of our lives, to learn how to integrate this into our perspective. And I do think that this takes a different kind of mind, a different form of consciousness, if you will. It takes a contemplative mind. It takes a going beyond our tendencies toward either-or thinking and to integrate life and death as a sort of holism, as a sort of life cycle, if you will. And here I want to also recall Judith Valente's reflections when she witnessed the sisters burying her friend, who was also a sister at the monastery. Do some of you recall that scene from the book? And she said of their grieving process in honoring the dead, that these must be the only truly free people in America. The way they were able to celebrate the life of this person, to honor the passing of this person, to accept and to grieve publicly and loudly the passing of this person, displayed for Judith a sort of freedom, which some of us, you know, we're all, I think, in a sense, learning into how to display. So perhaps I want to suggest this morning that maybe, as Valerie Carr has reflected, the darkness of the tomb is actually a womb. Maybe the darkness of the tomb is actually a womb. Or perhaps, as John O'Donohue has put it, maybe death is a kind of birth. Maybe death is a kind of birth. And he says this sort of in reflecting upon the death experience as a priest who has walked with many people through that. But he uses it as a grand metaphor for the spiritual life. That there's always this sort of birthing process that's happening by death. Now, I want to make this practical for a moment, if I might, because I think it's easy for, again, these topics to be so mysterious and so paradoxical. And when we talk about the contemplative mind, we can get into non-duality and regions of darkness really quickly. But I think that this is actually a very practical piece of advice for us. I think that that's how Jesus means it. I think that that's how most good contemplative teachers mean it, is that somehow this invitation needs to be embodied. It needs to be lived in us. And so I said at the outset that in our time this morning, that contemplative teaching is inherently mystical in the sense that it's trying to illustrate a boundary for us that we might go beyond in order to experience that reality, which is the mystery of holding this paradox. So when you encounter non-dual language in any way from a contemplative teacher, what they're trying to say should not make rational sense, because it's illustrating the boundary of our ability to even think. And it's an invitation to move beyond it into a deeper level of experiencing something beyond your rational mind. That's why a lot of meditative teachers will say, okay, we're going to observe our thoughts and start to detach and let them go, right? Because they want you to descend into a kind of experience that is beyond articulation, right? So I know that for me, I just want to admit this morning and hopefully say with this group that the initial orientations to this embrace of death were not weathered gracefully by me or by my soul in terms of this contemplative invitation to descend, right? Some of you might have heard of the path of descent. By that, I guess I mean that when you start pushing through toward this mysterious region where death is included in life and there's a holism there, it comes at a great cost. It comes at a great cost. That cost, I think, is what I might call something like the grief of objectification, the grief of objects, which, you know, is not dissimilar to a grief that would be associated to our attachments, right? To attaching ourselves to objects. When we view anything in our spiritual lives as objects, as something to be beheld, as something to be understood, something to be grasped, whether that's our life itself, whether that's God as an object, whether that's the spiritual stages we move through as objects, that is, when we view these things as something to be grasped by our rational minds, we will eventually have to grieve those objects. We will eventually have to let them go. We'll eventually have to forgive them for not adding up to all that we thought they were. And as the invitation to this contemplative beyond will not come with a new object, even if that object is peace or love or God or what have you, right? We can't make objects out of those things either. I think that it comes mostly as a cloud of unknowing. It becomes mostly as an invitation to a darkness that is a great light. Again, we're hitting at some symbols here that don't make any sense. And yet God in the Old Testament is what? Pillar of cloud and smoke and fire. the two most ethereal substances we could ever conceive of, right? Because they're not meant to say that God is literally a pile of fire or literally a cloud of smoke, but that God, as a representative word or placeholder, is somehow beyond our best attempts to objectify. And so it comes as a cloud of unknowing. A grief is often, I think, the path to unknowing. We grieve the objects that we've made of our spiritual lives. We grieve our religious symbols sometimes because they end up needing to be broken open so that we can move more deeply into this place. And I think and Tom had the precursor to this, that this is why St. Francis often wept. It's said that he went and wept, whether when he was walking on the road or when he went into a cave to be in silence and solitude, that he was a weeper. And Richard Rohr says of this that the mode of weeping is different than fixing or understanding. I want to make sure that we hear that. The mode of weeping is different than fixing or understanding. We cry when we forgive. The process of grief, the process of tears, the process of weeping is a process of forgiveness, of deep forgiveness of reality. And so we cry when we forgive because it's a giving up of trying to make rhyme or make reason or make blame or try to fit our experience of something as transcendent as suffering or death into our boxes, into an object that makes sense. And the dualistic mind never finds home base. When we try to categorize something like death, we can never find home base. St. Francis wept so much because it's an inner attitude of letting go of control, of forgiveness, of weeping over it. It's a different mode of being. Now, here's why I brought this up this morning. And I thought that it might be a practical thought for us all today. A friend of mine who's a pastoral psychologist out at Vanderbilt Divinity School, whose name is Bruce Rogers Vaughn, has written on the dialectic between love and grief. Love and grief. Namely, that grief is really only love under the condition of absence. I'm going to say that again because it's something to sit with. Grief is really only love under the condition of absence. And so he says of grief, that grief does not end. It does not cease because it is indistinguishable from love. Grief is essentially love under the condition of absence. We experience grief as an absence that is simultaneously a presence, and a presence that is simultaneously an absence. What is he trying to say? If you've ever lost somebody, and you are going about your day and you hear a song that reminds you of them, they are somehow present to you in their absence, are they not, in that moment? And most people who recall these kinds of experiences to Bruce in his clinical work recall them positively, even though it brought about grief, it brought about weeping, because they felt connected for a moment to this person again, right? And similarly, I think that the absence sort of presents itself as a kind of presence, right? It's not just absence. There is just absence being without something, but there is absence that is a kind of presence, meaning that you are once again connected to that which is absent. Somehow. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But I think that the heart of this teaching is that we are invited to grieve our various attachments, what I called earlier our objectifications, the objects that we make, in order to move to the place where death can become life. And essentially, I think we have to move into a place of absence, or to a presence of absence, or to an absence of presence, perhaps, in order to be in that place. And here we go, right, back into the contemplative mind again. This is starting to sound really non-dual, isn't it? Right? An absence that is a presence, this is non-dual thinking. In fact, Bruce goes a step further and says that this is actually indicative of our relationship to God as well. And I think it describes the very heart of the contemplative path when he says this: we cannot always feel God directly, but we can long for God. And this longing is an indescribable grief at the heart of our being. To love God is to grieve for God. To believe in God is to love God, or to long for God. And today I know what it feels like to truly love God. It feels like grief. Has anybody ever had that experience of absence with God? Right? Or when you kind of go into that existential mode and you feel a withdrawing of presence, a withdrawing of love, right? Okay. So this is what he's talking about here. I think more simply said, it could be said that to believe in God is to long for God. And to long for God is somehow to grieve the absence of God. And to grieve God is a symbol of your love for God. Right? Because love and grief are actually indistinguishable from each other. And to love God is to embrace the mystery of this contemplative invitation into dying that is a living. And this is to build compassion toward death, I think. This is to give us a sense of forgiveness for the way things are, which always comes in the form of this presence of absence. And God is slippery, right? Like, you know, it's not an object that's easy to behold, like one of those, you know, attachments that we have. So what is this invitation? I don't want us to miss that something else that Bruce highlights here is that this path of awakening, the path of integrating death into our lives, is not only a path of grief, but it's a sign of love. It's a sign of love. You see, I think that love is a way to describe this process of letting go. Love is a way to describe this process of letting go, of dying in order to live, of forgiving reality for what it is. It's going to take great love for us to forgive death. In fact, I don't think that we can do it on our own. I think that it's divine. I think that it's something that's beyond our ability to muster in any kind of will to power, right? I can't will myself to do it all the time. And so we fall instead. We fall into that divine embrace of this ability. And it's not really a work of ourselves. And so, what do we do in this regard? I think that love is a way to describe this process of letting go, like I said, of forgiving reality for what it is. It is just that it's often a path of grief, and nobody wants to opt in on grief. You know what I mean? What do we do when we're left on the other side of death? Right? We're not necessarily talking about just our own, but those that we encounter in our lives. And I want to make this particular and practical in terms of you've all had, I'm sure, some encounter with loss. But if we really think about our lives, we start to realize that where did yesterday go? It's gone. Where did that sentence go that I just said? It's gone, right? And so when we start to have eyes to see this, you can start to see a pattern that is playing out in much larger scale everywhere around us. And so it's often this path of grief that awakens us to presence, to be able to see the passingness of things, and then to say, what do I want to do on the other side? In essence, how do I want to live on the other side of this? And what do we do when we're left on the other side of death, even if it's a contemplative or a mystical death? We grieve, do we not? And grief, for me, and I've learned this from Bruce, is essentially a sign of love. That we somehow still love life on the other side. And the path of descent is only a path of falling into love. Or falling in love, if you want to say that. If we've ever set out on this inward journey, we know this wisdom to be true. It may sound like a bit of a contradiction this morning, maybe a paradox, like I said at the outset, but we know that when we give up our attachments or our objects, when we head down into our shadow and our pain and our fear, it feels like death. And it is not fun, like I said. But it's a sort of dying into life. It is what Richard Rohr calls a sort of falling upward, right? Some of you have heard that language. It is a falling that turns into flying, in a sense. And that we need to remember that Merton said at the beginning that this death leaves behind all that we can know or treasure as life, as thought, as experience, as joy, and as being. What? If that doesn't just set you off into paradox land, I don't know what will. That this death somehow leaves behind all that we can know or treasure as life, as thought, as experience, as joy, and as being. Now, does he mean that somehow all those things are going to be gone when we take this path? No, he does not. He means that when we try to objectify them, we miss the deeper stream, right? But when we enter this path into this deeper stream and we take this path of descent where dying is a way of living, I think then life and thought and experience and joy and being sort of re-emerge with a deeper fullness and a roundness and a vitality that they didn't have as objects in our perception or in our thinking. And so we know that if we stay the course on Merton's invitation, we will have to both love and grieve, will we not? But hopefully we can enter into this in a sort of trust. And this is where faith comes in, right? It's a trust that we are ever only falling into love or fear. And that my invitation for us this morning is in some sense to choose to fall into love, not fear. You see, fear is our initial reaction to death. I think it's natural. I think it's human. And yet those of us who have had to encounter this and kind of work through this and start to do the deeper soul work on grief, know that this fear is a path to love. That we are only falling into the deeper embrace, which is love. And so this morning, may we choose to fall into love, which I think is another way to say, may we choose to die so that we might live. May we choose to live with that paradox that Jesus taught, that the great teachers have taught. And to let our new orientation in our suffering be to learn to forgive it, to learn to invite divine forgiveness, to learn to somehow cooperate with God in forgiving reality for being what it is. And then maybe we can hold together this great mystery that is this invitation, and this great mystery that is our experience of the world of becoming and perishing. I want to finish just by playing a song for us that has been meaningful to me as I've tried to walk in this reality. And so Tom, I think, is going to turn this little speaker on. And we're going to let this be our sending out into break this morning.
Nowhere to go. The grave is lazy. He takes our bodies slow. And I said, please, don't talk about the end. Don't talk about how everything goes away. She said, friend, all alone, thought I was learning how to take, how to bend, not how to break, how to laugh, not how to cry. But really, I've been learning how to die. I've been learning how to die.
Thank you. All right, we look forward to having some conversation after the break.